Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Jessica Lewis will be sharing a little bit about her recent Paralympic journey. So recently you gathered some people together to share the inside story on your time at the Paralympics. Tell me a little about that.
So it was a program with the organization See What She Can Do, as well Brianna Hennessy, who is a athlete for Canada. She competes in canoe and kayak. So we both shared a little bit of our experience in Tokyo. Tokyo was my third games, and it was Brianna's first. So it was really awesome to kind of get a cross scope of the different experiences.
So in terms of accessibility over there, did you find that they were well prepared to host you and your fellow athletes?
Yes, they did. Yeah, they did an absolutely phenomenal job. You know, they had accessible buses available for us. They had like the ramps and everything to get onto the transport. There was the dining hall for the first time was two floors, and that was both floors were fully accessible. You could get to either by an elevator or even a ramp. They were all just super, super accommodating.
So what stood out the most for you in terms of the accommodations and accessibility over there?
I think probably just like having the ramp in the dining hall, because it was the two stories, because the elevators could get a little bit busy as well with people coming and going, so it was nice to have a second option to do that. They also had these little cars that could transport you around the village as well, because it was quite spaced out, so if you had trouble pushing or walking long distances, they were there to assist you with that as well.
So, as a Paralympic athlete, can you tell me a little bit about how you prepared yourself going into the experience?
So this was my third games, but each games is definitely so different on, how you prepare for it. And for Tokyo, a lot of my focus was to get a little bit stronger and more powerful. That would help me be more competitive in the longer races that I do, which is the 400 and 800. So I definitely think that worked out really well because I came away with a personal best time in my 800. And then I finished fourth in my 100, which is my best event. So for that, we just kind of focused on my starts and making sure that they were quick and I could have a fast reaction time to the gun. So it was kind of a mix of endurance stuff as well as sport-specific or sprint-specific.
So one thing I've heard from athletes with disabilities a lot of times over the years is when you're actually out competing, you're not thinking about what might hold you back. You're just giving your best and being in a high-performance game and just living in the moment. You have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, definitely. I think, for me, before competition or before any race, I kind of get in my head a lot just thinking about, what I have to do, have a fast start, make sure my transition is good through the turns on the track. So I think definitely beforehand, I think a lot more, but I think once I get to the track and get to the start line, all of that kind of just magically disappears and I just go into, I guess, the zone and just focus on, here I am at the highest level of competition, and I just got to go out there and do what I know that I can and what I've been doing in training.
So, was there any particular moment or success you experienced during the games that really stood out for you?
I think, at the games when I came fourth in the 100 meter, which is the highest ranking that I've ever finished, which was a 2-place advancement since Rio in 2016. Right afterwards, I was a little upset just because I was so close to the podium. But now that I've had, some separation from it, I'm really, really proud of accomplishing that. And I'm really looking forward to, this next bit of training towards the Paris Paralympic Games.
So, do you have any advice for any young athletes out there who might be questioning, can I really do this? Can I get into sport? And if I set myself to it, could I achieve the level of excellence that you've modeled for them?
Definitely. The one thing that I always say is just to believe in yourself. Every single person has a limitation of some kind. And, we just got to find a way not to focus on that and really realize that, hey, I can still accomplish amazing things. I can still set huge, massive goals for myself and go through with it. As well as, there is going to be a lot of hard work that goes into it. And it's just kind of finding the support network around you to help you through those tough moments. But definitely just believe in yourself and know that you can do it.
So you see yourself going to the next round at the Paralympics. Do you have a particular goal in mind for something you'd like to achieve the next time out?
So my focus now, I think, is that I'm going to switch a little bit and just focus on the 100 and 400 meter races, which are the ones that I'm more competitive in. So that will change the way that I train a little bit to being a lot more sprint focused. So a lot of high intensity workouts, as well as building in a little bit more of a power workout so that I can get a little bit stronger and more powerful on the front of my push, which will hopefully help me in my 100 meter get to that podium.
So what are the next immediate steps in your training?
So right now, I've only just been back in my chair for about 3 weeks. I had a month off after Tokyo. So it's just been a lot of kind of general workouts just to get me back in and get my muscles used to it again. And then we're going to start transitioning probably in January to doing a lot more high-intensity workouts as well as sprint style or like speed styles, trying to get my speed up higher and holding it longer. And then our first race will hopefully be in Switzerland in May next year.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Perfect. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure.
In this segment of our show, Tom DeMaria will be telling us a little bit about creative growth.
So, can you tell me a little bit about creative growth?
Well, sure. Creative Growth is based in Oakland, California, which is right near San Francisco, and we are, to our knowledge, the oldest and largest independent art studio for people with disabilities. We serve primarily people with developmental disabilities. We were founded in the early 1970s at a time when California deinstitutionalized people with developmental disabilities, and artists got together at the time wondering what the path forward would be for these folks that were institutionalized and started in their own home an art program and invited newly deinstitutionalized people to come and be creative as a path forward, both as personal expression and as a path for community integration.
So I'm guessing the art itself was a form of self-healing, therapeutic.
It is therapeutic. We don't have a formal art therapy practice. Art therapy is something that you study. It's an engaged, dynamic process. But there's something extremely therapeutic that happens with art making. So we like to say that it has great therapeutic benefit for our people, although we're run by artists for artists, and that's the path forward. Many of our people, particularly the older generation that had been institutionalized, were really never allowed to engage with society or communicate in a way that was meaningful or powerful. And, you know, we found that when you open the door and say, tell me your stories, tell me about who you are, something profound and deeply communicative happens. And that in and of itself can be extremely therapeutic and empowering.
So how do you go about reaching out to the disability community to let them know about your arts programs?
Sure. Well, it's changed. Originally, it was when people were just being deinstitutionalized years ago. You'd work with social workers or psychologists or anyone that might know, how to reach the community. Now, as the whole idea of disability has changed, particularly in the San Francisco Bay Area, that we had profound impact on the disability rights movement in the U.S. and the passage of the ADA legislation. So much of that came out of the Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco movements of the time. Things have changed, and people with disabilities are more mainstreamed into schools. We serve adults with disabilities starting at age 21. But we have outreach programs to high schools, to vocational programs, schools, teachers, board and care facilities, also other disability rights organizations, and we really try to throw a pretty wide net out there to have people come and work at our program. The program is open to, we're fully enrolled, but there's a waiting list, but it's open to any person with a disability over the age 21 who feels like this could be a path forward for them. So there's an intake process, and they'll come and look around the studio, and if it's seems like a path forward, the person can come and work for free there, and we provide all the support and artistic materials, and they become a part of our community.
So, in that sense, do you use any modified equipment or techniques with the artists?
We do have some. Because we primarily serve people with developmental disabilities, we do have some artists with physical disabilities or multiple disabilities, and we have some adaptive, like in our wood shop, we have adapted tools. And, you know, as you might imagine, there's not a lot of ready-made equipment that you can go out and buy. So, you know, we had a design program with the California College of the Arts one year where design students came and made adaptive equipment for our people so that they could use saws or sanding materials or power tools or use the kiln or how we adjust chair height, how we sort of adjust, you know, we have head painters where the paintbrush is attached to someone's head or onto their arm so they can paint on the floor. So we've really had to become entrepreneurial and innovative in terms of how we adapt when people need physical needs. In terms of, we also have ASL interpreters. We speak a number of languages. We have, you know, folks that are nonverbal, and we try to communicate in as many different kinds of ways. You know, we're one large open studio. Increasingly, as we serve a greater number of people on the autism spectrum, we have to adjust parts of the studio so that there's more sound isolation or more privacy for some of our artists who prefer that. And some of our artists also prefer to work with technology. So we have a large digital program with iPads and screen interfaces that some of our artists feel is a more comfortable arena for them to work.
So, in your time with Creative Growth, has there been any success case that stands out for you?
Sure, there's several. Right now, last week, we opened a one-man show in London at a studio called Studio Voltaire, art gallery there, of a Creative Growth artist named William Scott. William's born in San Francisco. He's dual diagnosed with developmental disabilities and schizophrenia. He was sort of marginalized growing up as an African-American kid years ago when there really weren't any sort of resources for people with disabilities or children with disabilities to have access to media, let alone art making. And he, through the grace of a local librarian, he found his way to our program, where he's developed a significant body of work over the 30 years he's worked with us. It's in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, the Studio Museum of Harlem, and his one-man show in London that opened last week. And I think about a young African-American man with dual diagnoses, sort of becoming the first such artist to have his work collected by the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and you really have to see what a triumph this is for him, and what a role model he's become for other such artists.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making cocktails. Maybe you're packing bowls. Even while we're distancing, it's important to remember, alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks could save a life. And we can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Paralympic athlete Jessica Lewis, and Tom DiMaria told us a little bit about Creative Growth. In this segment of our show, Gareth Evans will be telling us a little bit about Carousel. So, can you tell me a little bit about the work of Carousel?
Yes, absolutely. Carousel is, we are a learning disability-led arts organisation. And by that, we mean that we have a core group of artists that we support in different ways to lead on the development of our program of work. We have been, next year actually will be our 40th year. We're based in Brighton in the UK, although quite a lot of our work, particularly our kind of our public facing work, does reach nationally and international audiences. The work we do falls in different program areas. So we have a program of work that is looking at music and radio and audio-based projects. So we support a roster of learn disabled musicians who, some are solo artists, some are in bands, some are DJs. The solo artists and bands are all kind of supported by Carousel to create original music, and through their support, we'll facilitate rehearsals, recording sessions, through to kind of releasing and touring music. Our radio show is primarily a spoken words show. It's a bit of a magazine format, so it kind of involves lots of other aspects of Leonard Sable made art, and that's available locally as on FM radio, but as a podcast as well. And then we do have a second program of work that's film work and digital work. So we do a biannual international film festival that showcases films either featuring or produced or created by Leonard Sable filmmakers. We have our 10th festival in the new year. It's called Oscar Bright Film Festival, and we regularly have submissions from right around the globe to the festival, and it's now an Oscar nominating festival, so it's quite a significant piece of work in our work plan. And more recently we've just started a television show that's half hour, a real wacky affair, kind of involves all sorts of crazy segments, all kind of created by Learn Disabled people and featuring Learn Disabled people. We just yesterday premiered our second episode, so it's quite a new piece of work.
So, curious.
We're a busy lot.
So, how do you go about reaching out to the disability population to let them know that they can get involved in the arts?
We have fairly well-established links and connections locally with the kind of learned disabled community. A lot of that has come through regular events that we do. We run a club night, or certainly did run a club night pre-COVID, and through that we would have a large marketing strategy to ensure that Carousel was information both about the club, but about other opportunities to be involved, was reaching as far into the local community as possible. Obviously, kind of digitally, we invest quite a lot of stock in promoting our work online. We've got a real active Facebook channel, YouTube channel, and we actively promote the development of our mailing list. So we kind of have strategies around all of the work to try and reach as many people as we can, but always seeking out for new opportunities to kind of connect with organisations, schools, both locally but also around the globe to try and promote what we're doing.
So in terms of the disability musicians, their songs and creations tend to reflect stories about their disabilities themselves. I haven't found too much material in regards to this, so I'm always kind of curious.
There are examples of bands that we work with who've written songs that are related to their disability, or kind of more about their kind of their day-to-day lives as a disabled person. We kind of leave that, well, we try the best we can to leave that creative voice entirely to the artists. Whatever they feel like they want to write about is what we try and support them to write about. In terms of kind of themes, that the music that's created is very diverse. But I think it kind of, there's certainly a sort of approach to being creative that is fairly common with the artists who work. I'm not entirely sure how to describe, but I feel like there's something around the lack of inhibitions and just the freedom the people we work with have to express themselves honestly, and that kind of leads to a really, really interesting art and certainly music.
So, in your time with Carousel, is there any success story that stands out for you?
Oh, that's a really good question. There are kind of things that personally I'm very proud about, that my work through the organisation has always been more involved in the music and events, and there's small slices of success that our bands have had. That we had Zombie Crash were featured in Kerrang magazine here in the UK, and we supported a guy called Daniel Wakeford to kind of start his music career, and now he's you know, gone on to do some pretty exciting things. But I think I always feel like the moments that I feel most exhilarated for working for Carousel is when we have events and there's a large number of people with a learning disability who are coming together to really kind of own a space and really set the tone of how an event is going. And it's those moments when I'm immersed in that and can just take maybe a step back and look at people really having the space and the freedom to express themselves. And it's those sort of moments that I feel most proud about, I think.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Of course, yeah, no worries.
My friends, I'm so grateful that Jessica was willing to be a part of the show this week. So much as hearing about accessibility in other parts of the world, something we all should take a little time to do. The fact is, we can't get stuck and the accessibility concerns of home and say, that's all that matters, if it's right at our front doorstep. No. Accessibility is a need here at home. It's a need in other parts of the world. For those who came out to support the Paralympic athletes, they were representative of humanity's progress in some ways. Steps forward, not only in our understanding of accessibility and accommodation, but our appreciation of it. For those cheering on a Paralympic athlete, we're there to see a high-performance game. They're not thinking about any little thing that might not be the same as an Olympic athlete. Fact is, for the athletes themselves, they're just living in the moment, living off the adrenaline rush, being a part of a team, being a part of a sport. That's really as it should be. There's nothing more freeing in disability life, I've heard it said, than being a part of sport. I mean, for Jessica, something she loves, and something she is going to continue. For the next games, I have no doubt that she'll excel even farther. This time, it's really a wonderful thing. She was able to achieve a personal best, and that is something to carry with her. But as with any athlete, the question is, how much farther can I take it tomorrow? And I do believe this is something she's going to keep in mind. And for all the athletes out there, it really was a great thing. They were given a chance to showcase their abilities, not their disabilities. People weren't out there saying, oh, it's great that someone with a disability can do this. No, they were out there saying, these are terrific athletes. And they are. The fact is, disability is one part of the equation of a person. It's not the totality of it. It's not all defining or all limiting. Most people think of disability, they think limit. Well, I think of it in terms of what can be a great strength, great motivator, something that reminds us the human spirit truly is unbreakable. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.